This is The Guardian.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Looking for your next great podcast? We live in unprecedented times. To make sense of it, what if you could learn from some of the most influential people on the planet? The podcast Tools and Weapons is hosted by Microsoft's Vice Chair and President Brad Smith. Every week, he has a candid conversation with guests, including prime ministers and Pulitzer Prize-winning journalists. The latest episode features Bayer CEO Bill Anderson. Though most of us know Bayer for pharmaceuticals, they're also focused on crop science. They're putting digital tools in the hands of farmers to get the most out of every acre. Listen to Tools and Weapons with Brad Smith, wherever you get your podcasts.
When it comes to food, Labradors and Retrievers have got themselves a bit of a reputation.
Leo is a very big, chunky black Labrador. Anything there is there to eat, he will eat it.
Catherine's dog, Leo, stops at nothing for a nice bit of grub.
We were having a barbecue at our house once and everybody had brought some food and we put the desserts under the table and so all of a sudden someone saw Leo under the table and he'd eaten half a bowl of trifle.
Leo just can't resist. And he's not alone. The Royal Veterinary College has described obesity in dogs as a modern-day epidemic.
We've trained him that he shouldn't pick vegetables out of the vegetable garden. So now he won't do it if we're there. He just does it if he thinks we're not looking.
When she was trying to get to the bottom of Leo's insatiability, Catherine came across a study.
I saw an advert for people who had Labradors wanting to take part in this research into obesity in Labradors. I thought it would be an ideal activity for him to do and it might give me some answers.
What she found out did provide some answers.
It helps us understand why he's like this, but it hasn't changed in anything that we do with him because we've always been really careful about how much he eats and kept food out of his way. You do forget at times. I bought a baguette in the baker's last weekend and we had it in the kitchen and we were busy outside doing something. I came in for lunch and I couldn't find it until we found the wrapper on the floor and Leo had eaten it all.
But what this research discovered doesn't just say something about Leo, Labradors, or even just dogs. It actually reveals a lot about us, too. So today on Science Weekly, what can our dogs teach us about the human obesity crisis? From The Guardian, I'm Madeleine Finlay, and this is Science Weekly. Nicola Davis, you're a Guardian science correspondent and our in-house canine expert. And recently you wrote about the Cambridge University research that Catherine's dog Leo was involved in, which was looking at the genetics of Labradors and flat-coated retrievers, and a mutation in one particular gene called POMC, which might explain why they're such greedy guts. Now, you have a flat-coated retriever yourself. When you were covering this research, did you think, you know, this actually sounds like my dog?
Well, it's interesting because in the research, they talk about how this genetic variant is found in about a quarter of Labradors and about two thirds of flat-coated retrievers. So that's quite a high proportion. So that's they either carry one or two copies. And I did turn around and look at my flatty and think, I wonder if you've got it. I wouldn't call her a greedy guts. In that you could leave food on the table and she wouldn't try and get at it. But equally, there was one very memorable occasion where I was on my hen party before I got married, and my husband was at home with the dog, and halfway through I had this rather plaintive message from my husband saying that he just prepared a beautiful marinated steak, popped it on the grill, turned away just to check something, and when he looked back, it just wasn't there anymore. I don't know. I was looking at her thinking, are you the exception, or do you have these variants lurking within?
And so, Nicola, you've done this genetic test on your dog, and you're going to reveal to us later whether or not she's got the mutation. But there is a bigger picture here, and it's about an obesity crisis in our pets.
Absolutely. I mean, it's been something that a lot of vets have been very worried about. And I think what's interesting about this study is that it's been trying to look at what might be behind that. To what extent is this nature? To what extent is this the environment in which the animals are living in? What are these factors that might be at play? We know that in animals and in humans, obviously, as well, that obesity is not a simple condition. It can be a range of issues that can feed into that. I think what's interesting here is looking at a kind of animal model and saying, what can we learn from what's happening in animals that might help us to understand better what's happening in humans?
And so you went to Cambridge to talk to the researchers and to try and unravel this a little bit.
Yes, exactly. I thought it'd be really good to go and talk to those involved in this research.
I'm Eleanor Raffin. I'm a researcher and vet who works at the University of Cambridge as a lecturer. We started off studying Labradors initially because they've got this reputation as being like really foodie dogs and very obesity prone as a consequence. And actually we did a very simple kind of genetic study where we looked at the sequence of DNA for some well understood genes, one of which was a gene called POMC. And it turns out that the Labradors are missing a chunk of DNA within the gene, and that alters the way that the gene functions and how the dog's brains process the signals to do with eating and energy expenditure.
So, Eleanor, for the first study, which was a few years ago now, wasn't it? Pre-pandemic,
yeah.
You found this genetic variant. Then you've recently had this other study come out. Tell me a bit about what you did in the latest work.
What we did was delve a little bit deeper. We wanted to be quite specific about which aspects of their eating behaviour were different, because we understand that the genes and the biology that govern whether you feel hungry are different to the brain circuits that govern whether you feel full after a meal, for instance. And so we did some really fun experiments in the lab where we measured how hungry dogs got with something called the sausage in a box test.
That sounds like a great test.
It was really fun. It kind of does what it says on the tin. We literally showed these guys a sausage and then video recorded them for 5 minutes. And what we found was that the dogs who had our mutation were just much more persistent in seeking out the sausage and much less interested in this kind of new environment that they found themselves in. And we've looked in all sorts of breeds of dogs, and the only purebred dogs that the mutation has popped up in is flat coats. And actually, it's even more common in flat coats than it is in retrievers. And that was why, when we did the second part of our experiments, which weren't about the kind of how much food you take on board, but how many calories you burn every day, we did that in the flat coats because we could test dogs with two copies of the mutation. And that was the bit that flagged up some really new and quite striking results, which showed that the dogs, as well as being hungrier, also burn off fewer calories as they go about their daily lives, not because of their exercise, but because of how much energy their body is using in the background. And of course, what we got was a whole bunch of people who said, oh, well, that's why I find it so hard to keep my dog slim. Or they kind of felt reassured by the fact that their dog's putting on a little bit of extra weight wasn't just that they were perhaps being complacent or lazy about how they manage their dog's food. It's just that they've got a much bigger challenge to try and keep a dog at a healthy weight.
Can you tell me a bit about why that might have cropped up? And presumably it has some sort of benefit, or had some sort of benefit somewhere in these dogs' ancestry.
Quite possibly. So there was a common ancestor dog, the St. John's water dog, and they were fishermen's dogs in 16th century Newfoundland. So their job was to leap into the icy waters and retrieve the fishermen's nets. And you can imagine that in that context, a willingness to eat any rotten fish head that came your way and a propensity to have a layer of blubber under your skin would probably have been no bad thing. And we had a striking finding when we first discovered this, that we noticed that the mutation is there in about a quarter of pet Labradors. But if you look in the guide dog population, population. It's there in about 2/3 of them. And it just raises this intriguing question as to whether maybe being a very highly food motivated dog makes you that bit more willing to work for food. So possibly we have inadvertently selected for this. I must say that as yet we haven't been able to put a clear link between this particular mutation and trainability.
Obviously, you've only found these genes in two breeds so far. Do you think that then that helps to explain why we're having an obesity crisis in our pet population?
This result is very much specific to the breeds that we've looked at. But I think what it does is provide a very potent and clear illustration of how one single genetic change can really profoundly alter the way a dog's body handles energy and how much food they want to take on board. And those kind of variations are happening all across the dog population and actually all across the human population, albeit on a more subtle level.
I've just come out from chatting to Eleanor Raffin about her study. Absolutely fascinating. I had no idea that one genetic variant could have such a profound effect on how these dogs experience the world around them, their relationship with food, the energy they consume when at rest. But now I want to go and find out whether something similar might be happening in humans. I'm going to go off and talk to Giles, who I'm hoping might be able to tell me a bit more.
Hello.
Hello, I'm Giles.
Hi, Giles. Nice to meet you. I'm Nicola.
Nicola, hello. Come on upstairs, guys.
Sorry, we're a bit late.
Happy to do this in my office? I think
yes.
It's relatively.
I think that's perfect. Yeah, that's great.
Hello, my name is Giles Yeo, and I am a professor here at the University of Cambridge, where I study the genetics of body weight and how our brain controls food intake.
So, Giles, you are part of the study that we spoke to Eleanor about. You're a co-author on that. But your field more is human genetics generally. And so how big a problem in the human world is obesity?
Pardon the pun, it is enormous. 1 in 8 people in the world, you know, have obesity. Okay, that's an average, where actually 1 in 4 in this country have obesity, 1 in 3 in the United States. And over the past, I would say, 10 years, we have reached an inflection point where there are now more people in the world dying because of overnutrition than undernutrition. Obesity has always been a problem, but never to the degree we see it now. Hence, the rise is going to be environmental. Where the genetics come in, however, is in the fact that not everyone has obesity, right? In the same environment, that is where the genetics actually lies. An example I always give, so I'm not from here originally. When I first came here, stores were still not open on Sundays. So if on a Sunday evening, I suddenly had a craving for a bowl of cereal, but I didn't have milk or I didn't have cereal, tough luck. I'd have to wait till Monday morning, right? Now, clearly, not only are stores open on Sunday, if you are in a major metropolitan area, you can actually call a food delivery and someone will deliver it to your front door, okay? So while the feelings, while the genetic drivers, the biology have all been there, this has not changed. Our ability to act on it has.
How big is the genetic influence? What does it look like?
The heritability of body weight ranges from 40 to 70%. So it's a pretty big range. If you take an average, it's roughly 50-50. And we know that the vast majority of these genes act within the brain and influence our behavior around food. Your brain needs to know, broadly speaking, 2 pieces of information in order to influence your feeding behavior. It needs to know how much fat you have, because how much fat you have is how long you would last in a wild without any food. So it's a pretty important integer to hold in your head, and it's going to be hormones from fat. So that's long-term energy. And it needs to know your short-term energy signals, what you're currently eating and what you have just eaten. And these are also going to be hormonal, but they're going to come from your gut. So your brain senses these long and short-term signals, signals from fat, signals from your gut, and then influences your next interaction with a menu, with a refrigerator, with your next meal.
So is this down to single genes? Are we talking about one of these situations where you have lots of different genes all acting together in a very complex and knotty way? I mean, obviously in the dogs there, we had one genetic variant you could see the effect of. Is that what's happening in humans as well?
There are going to be rarer variations with very large effects in humans and far more common variation in human beings having little tiny itsy-bitsy teeny-weeny effects. We now, for example, know of over 1,000 genes that are linked in some way or other to our body weight. But within the pathway, you know, that is mutated within the dogs, for example, this is called the leptin-melanocortin pathway. And it is, put simply, the fat sensing pathway within our body, the brain fat sensing pathway. The 0.3% of people, for example, we find that have mutations in the receptor for POMC. At 18 years old, on average, just to give you an idea of scale, they are 18 kilos heavier on average. And so that's more than 40 pounds. Yeah. Now, that is an average, which means that actually some people are down at the minuscule, you know, 2 to 3 kilos, so it's a half a stone maybe, okay, up to people who are 40 kilos heavier. So that's 80 to 90 pounds heavier because of one mutation in one gene.
What does this tell us about how we as humans should be doing in terms of managing our own weight? Like, when it comes to my dog, it is hard work to measure her food all the time. We use a slow feeder bowl. We monitor all of her treats. Like, we're very, very careful. And it's hard and it is tiring. And it's not even me that's eating the food. Does that give us a sort of, does that change the way we think about body weight in humans?
I would like to think so, but society tends to, and this still is the prevailing view, sadly, blame the people suffering from the condition of obesity. They think it's a choice. They think it's a bad habit. In fact, you can say that obesity is a combination of your genes meeting an environment, and ultimately there are some behavioral things that you can do about it.
And obviously in my dog's life, you can't do anything about her genetics. But regardless of what her genetics are, in a way, I'm the arbiter of her environment. Do we as humans need somebody to be taking on that role?
Obesity is a public health problem. The NHS is spending something close to £6 to 7 billion a year in direct costs on obesity. But if you look at the indirect costs of obesity, we're probably looking at £27 billion per annum, missing time off work, that kind of thing, because obesity tends to affect people in the working age. A public health problem needs to be dealt with in a public health scenario, which means that if you try and think only about personal responsibility, and yes, fair, there is some level of personal responsibility. It's my health, it's my children's health. I got to do something about that. But if you don't fix the environment, you won't fix the problem, because ultimately your genes set the thermostat in how you behave around the food environment that you're in. Because you can control the environment you live in, I guess, your house, your apartment, and your fridge. But the moment you step out the front door, the moment you go to your supermarket, not even the supermarket, you go to, you know, Boots or you to get paracetamol, you go to WH Smith to buy a pencil, and you are assaulted by chocolate. Okay, so I think I'm not anti-chocolate. Not, I sound like I'm not anti-chocolate. But I feel that the problem is, if you are faced with chocolate bars everywhere, and whatever your personal weakness and foibles happen to be, but it's assaulting you, okay, as you're going there to not buy a chocolate bar, but that's what being sold to you, then I think that's an issue. People with obesity, people who are overweight, they are fighting their biology. And I think ultimately that's what we gotta understand.
Nicola, your chat with Giles has genuinely made me think about food and body weight in a new light. There are obviously limits to the parallels that can be drawn between humans and dogs, but one thing that I've been really reflecting on is that when I heard about the Labrador genetics from your reporting, I thought, oh, they're not greedy guts. It's that their biology is different and they're always going to have a harder time keeping additional weight off, and their owners are going to have a harder time. And yet, despite what we know about genetics in humans and the fact that it's so complicated, because we each have our own individual experience with food and weight, it's hard to understand and remember that somebody else's experience might be entirely different. And we have to do the work to keep that in mind. So, look, Nicola, let's get to the moment that I've really been waiting for. Does your dog have the variant or not?
Well, whether or not she had these genes, the jury really was out. You can't chop a carrot without her materialising like a little poltergeist. If chicken's being cooked, she's stuck to you like glue. But equally, we can leave food on a low table and she wouldn't touch it. I thought, I don't know, it could go either way. So I was quite surprised when I clicked on the email and it said in big capital letters, affected. And I asked the team, I said, does she have one variant or does she have two? And I was really shocked to find she had two variants. And it helped me to understand that perhaps she was being particularly good around food, considering that she was working against perhaps her natural genetic disposition. So I did find that very interesting. And she did get a bit of a cuddle and a good girl for that, because I think that it's not easy. But I think the other thing that's interesting as well, of course, is that when it comes to our pets, fundamentally, we are in control. Of course, when it comes to ourselves, we are an interested party. So, you know, it's not like there's somebody else. It's up to you. And time and again, we've seen that measures that could be taken to help people and to support people, whether that's banning adverts on junk food or the cost of different items, these kinds of measures just aren't taken. And so we're in a society which is very, very difficult for us as humans to maybe be as kind to ourselves as perhaps we are to our pets.
A big thanks to Nicola Davis and to Professors Eleanor Raffin and Giles Yeo. And that's it for today. This episode was produced by me, Madeline Finlay. It was sound designed by Joel Cox. And the executive producer is Ellie Bury. We'll be back on Thursday. See you then.
This is The Guardian.
Looking for your next great podcast? We live in unprecedented times. To make sense of it, what if you could learn from some of the most influential people on the planet? The podcast Tools and Weapons is hosted by Microsoft's Vice Chair and President Brad Smith. Every week, he has a candid conversation with guests, including prime ministers and Pulitzer Prize-winning journalists. The latest episode features Bayer CEO Bill Anderson. Though most of us know Bayer for pharmaceuticals, they're also focused on crop science. They're putting digital tools in the hands of farmers to get the most out of every acre. Listen to Tools and Weapons with Brad Smith, wherever you get your podcasts.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.